Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Lots of very warm texts about Charlie McGettigan there. Truly gifted songwriter, totally underrated, and one of life's gentlemen, said one. That about sums it up, doesn't it? Now, to a man who possibly wasn't one of life's gentlemen, Ridley Scott's Napoleon movie is coming out next week, and there's big hype over it. Historians are up in arms. But what it does probably demonstrate is people's ongoing fascination with Napoleon, almost a kind of a pop culture icon. So Dr. Laura O'Brien joins me now. Welcome, Laura.
Hi, Brendan. How are you?
And Laura, you are Associate Professor of Modern European History at Northumbria University. Before we start, can you give me the 1 minute potted history of Napoleon, or is that impossible?
Let's see if I can do the greatest hits. So he's born in 1769, born in Corsica. He dies in St. Helena in 1821. And in between, he does spectacular things, and he has an equally spectacular fall. He rises through the ranks of the French military. He becomes first consul, and then he becomes emperor. And then he does lots of battles and, you know, marries himself to the daughter of the Austrian emperor. And then he does more battles, and then he gets defeated, and then he goes to Russia, and, you know, and then he gets, that's bad, then he gets into exile. And then there's another exile, and then he comes back, and then he's finally defeated and sent off into his final exile on St. Helena, and that's a terrible rundown of the greatest hits of Napoleon Bonaparte.
But okay, but just suffice to say, he had a big impact in his short time on Earth, and still an object of fascination. You say he's kind of like a David Bowie kind of figure for people.
I think he's a Bowie in the sense of he sort of, there's lots of different Napoleons that exist through his life, in the sense of like how he would, I'm not saying that there's a kind of chameleon-like transformation from, you know, Ziggy into Aladdin Sane or what have you, but he's able to present different faces to the people that he wants, that need to see him a certain way. So he appears a certain way to his soldiers. This is one of the reasons why he dresses so comparatively simply most of the time. But then he's not afraid to do things like the coronation in 1804, when he goes really full on with this extremely elaborate coronation outfit, including a robe that weighed, I don't know, something like 60 kilos that he was desperate to get off once he finally got back to the palace. He's able to kind of shift his image. And he's, what's really interesting about him, and I think something that's very modern about him, is the way in which he was able to control his image or project his image really from quite early on in his career. And that's something he does even after he goes to St. Helena. He's still working to shape his legacy and shape the story that we keep coming back to the last 200 years.
Which can't have been easy back then to kind of, you know, with the media and everything now, it's easy to kind of myth make about yourself. And so image wise, he deliberately, he like curated his look all the time for the different situations, yeah.
I mean, he's, you know, this is something that really sort of kicks in after he's first consul, so which is kind of just before he decides to become an emperor. He wore the ordinary uniforms of the young generals, which he was leading at the time, the Republican army, which he was leading at the time. You know, he remained in military uniform for most of his life, but he's very careful to create this very, very immediately recognizable silhouette, the hat, the coat, the arm gesture, which is not something he invents. It's a common portraiture thing at the time, but it became so associated with him because of the simplicity of the silhouette. I mean, I remember reading something once that if you can recognize somebody by their silhouette, that means they're an icon. And I think the example the person was giving was Elvis, and you would, right? You would recognize Elvis with the hair and the hips and everything. But Napoleon, I think, is even better, because you just have to show the hat and you think, yep, that's him.
So he's a branding genius. And so obviously a healthy sense of himself. Like, you know, a lot of people now would consider that he is the model, if not the inventor, of kind of short man syndrome.
I mean, I think a healthy sense of himself. I think a friend of mine, or an extended family member, said to me recently, if he was made of chocolate, he'd lick himself, I think, this description. He's that kind of character. But he's very, and I mean, the thing is, he's, on some level, you kind of think, well, he's justified, because he's been able to create this extraordinary career that he would never have had if there was no French Revolution. But he's able to kind of project this image. I think the short man thing, the truth is he's about 5'6", 5'7", which isn't terribly short for the time. I mean, he's very slight as a young man. If you look at his uniforms from 1796, 1797, this is a very thin, very, very thin, gaunt young man. But really, the short man thing is kind of a hangover from British propaganda, where they were drawing him as tiny in these cartoons.
Okay. Yeah, right.
So we're still, I mean, when he gets older, he becomes obviously a little bit heavier. He's a little bit more sort of, he carries a bit more weight around the middle. And I think that exaggerates, that makes him look sort of shorter because he's wide around the middle. But I think early on, the stuff, the tiny, tiny Napoleons are as much about trying to take him down a peg as they are an actual reflection of what he looked like.
Everybody was at the image wars and the battles for mythology then. So then, and part of the mythology as well, Josephine has become part of it. And, you know, even like she has her own catchphrase, not tonight Josephine, will catchphrase about her. So she's kind of presented, I always think, a mixture of Claire Underwood from House of Cards, like there's that kind of vibe, and then a bit of a Molly Bloom element to it as well. Like was it a strategic alliance? Was it this tempestuous, passionate love story?
Well, the thing is, a lot of people told her that she was mad to marry this guy. She had several suitors, one of which actually is kind of fairly well known to Irish, if people are familiar with Irish history, Lazar Osh, who's involved in the Bantry Bay landing. He was sort of one of her potential go-to guys at the time, and he cuts it off. So people were sort of saying, what are you doing with this younger man? He seems a bit weird, but he's on the up. I think she needs protection. She has relationships with relatively powerful men and strategic alliances. But in him, I think she sees, you know, he's younger, he's mad about her, he's absolutely obsessed with her in the early years. She realises she's not getting any younger. She feels, okay, he's clearly on the ascent here, and this could be a way for me to secure my future as a woman who is a widow, who has two children, and who is that bit older, and may not have seemed like a very marriageable prospect at the time. For him, he initially, we think, possibly thought she had money, but then he just was madly in love with her. And it's a very lopsided affair early on. It's almost, you feel deeply sorry for him because he's just absolutely obsessed with her, like to a weird extent on some level. Okay. And she's sort of sitting there going, yeah, okay, I suppose so. But they do marry, and I think she is, you know, she's strategic in the sense of she's a supportive figure, but she's also quite detached. It's only really when he comes back from the Italian campaign that they start to kind of have more of a married life together, because he goes off on campaign almost immediately after their wedding, during which time she has an affair with someone else, but how and ever.
How do the French feel about Napoleon? Is it a complex relationship?
Yeah. I think when we had the bicentenary of his death 2 years ago, there was a lot of talk sort of saying, oh, now people are finally learning to be critical. And as someone who is a French historian and a specialist in France and has lived in France, I remember thinking, well, they've always been weird. They've always had this kind of like love-hate relationship. And he's always had opposition from the very beginning. I mean, right from the start, people have been opposed to this man politically, you know, ideologically, what have you. I think he kind of exists in the French mindset as sort of a figure in the background for most people. There's very few people who will be sort of very hardline for or against. Mm-hmm. I think the good thing is that most people are now very aware of the complexity of his legacy and the sort of much more unpleasant parts of the legacy in terms of things like reimposing slavery in parts of the French Caribbean. And of course, the human cost of the Napoleonic Wars, which was really a big factor in why people started to kind of turn against him towards the end of his reign, because essentially they're paying this. I think, you know, there's a 19th century French writer who describes it as like a tax that's being paid to Caesar in young men's lives every year, because there's conscription and because you have this huge, huge legacy of loss of life, but also disfigurement and so on. So he exists in this kind of, I suppose now the best way to describe it is like there was a lot of fuss in 2021 for good or for bad. But I think there's always been a sort of a difficult relationship with him in the French mindset.
So Joaquin Phoenix is Napoleon in this new film. Is he the right man for the job, do you think?
I mean, nobody who knows me will be surprised when I say I wish they'd made it like 20 years ago when he was kind of a little bit younger. And okay. I know that sounds awful. Yeah. I am concerned about how old he will look for the younger scenes. I kind of feel like they could have gone with a younger actor.
Like who?
Again, no one will be surprised. I think my personal current Napoleon pick would be Kieran Culkin. I think he's the right size. He's got the right weirdo energy. He's
amazing. He's, Roman Roy. So he kind of exemplifies it, does he?
Well, I mean, he looks a bit like him. I mean, there's some portraits of Napoleon as first consul that I just got and go, put a hat on that man. You've got this perfect. And he's got this sort of slightly insane energy about him, even in his interviews and stuff, that I kind of think you can see his career, but he's also very charismatic. And the one thing that we do know is that Napoleon had to have been extremely charismatic to do what he did. So I think there's like, he's clearly quite a strange character in a lot of ways, but he is also full of charisma. And I worry just from the trailer about, I mean, maybe Phoenix has managed to pull something off because he is a great actor. And but it's just that kind of, you know, is it charismatic enough as well as being sort of slightly, edgy enough, I guess. But we'll see. I think it's just when I see pictures of him as Napoleon as a young man in costume, it does look a little bit off. I don't know, but I'll have to see how it plays out on the big screen. I'll reserve my judgment then.
Listen, you're a great historian. You're really bringing all of this alive for us. And Ridley Scott is fighting with the historians now about historical inaccuracies, cannons firing at the pyramids and all that. I suspect you're not bothered about that, are you?
Do you know what? I mean, I work on Napoleonic performance. Like, that's one of the things that I do about Napoleon in theatre and film. And that makes me quite an outlier as a historian, but as a cultural historian, not really. And for me, I think every Napoleon that you see performed, like any historical figure that you see performed, is partially a work of imagination. And that's also because he created an image of himself, you know, that was partially a work of imagination as well. He does that by dictating his memoirs on St. Helena and sending these stories back to Europe. The things that I'm more fussed about, it's interesting to me that a lot of the historians are very annoyed about the military, as they see it, errors, the battle errors. They say, well, that's not how that battle happened. For me, it's more about the kind of, there's some sort of things that hint at him having perhaps an Oedipal complex with his mother and so on. On the one hand, I think, well, that gives me the ick a little bit. On the other hand, I'm not surprised, because you have to invent a historical figure when you're doing this kind of performance. I probably wouldn't go as far as what Scott has been saying, which has been quite blunt and in some cases quite rude. At the same time, there's part of me that kind of, as someone who works on this sort of stuff, who finds it really interesting that it can still provoke that very intense reaction. I kind of do agree with him. Yeah.
Yeah. Ultimately, your main issue with it is that they didn't put Kieran Culkin in it. And now you see, now that's going to be my issue. If I see it as well, I'm just going to be seeing, God, this would have been so much better with Kieran Culkin.
This would have been so much better. Maybe they'll make another series. Maybe they'll make a series and they'll put him in it. And then, you know,
I think we need to get that off the ground. Absolutely.
Yeah,
born to play Napoleon.
Absolutely.
Laura O'Brien, Associate Professor of Modern European History at Northumbria University. Thank you so much. We'll take a break.
Thank you.
Email brendan@rte.ie.